From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The saying goes, nothing's certain except death and taxes. But a big new look at the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, suggests it isn't even certain that the agency is up to the basic responsibilities of its job of collecting 90% of the country's revenue. Fraud is way up. Responsiveness to taxpayers, way down. So are collections. This hour on Point, deep troubles at the IRS. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Does the nation's tax collector still have what it takes to do the job? Have you seen it struggling? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Cranish, deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. He's just wrapped up a big two-part investigation of eye-popping troubles at the IRS. You can find a link to the Globe series at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Cranish, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Boy, have you got a lot in here. We all know that it's a fraught terrain and a lot of things can go wrong, but I had no idea that this much was going wrong. You quote the national taxpayer advocate, Nina Olson. She'll join us later. We'll ask her. But she says that the IRS is at risk of failing at its mission. What's she talking about, Michael?
Well, I thought it was extraordinary. I started on this project looking at a rather narrow issue, and I quickly came upon Nina Olson's report. Nina Olson works at the IRS. She has a large office at the fourth floor and has people who work for her, and her job is basically to tell Congress what's going on. Are there problems there? And so I read through her reports and talked to a lot of officials, including the IRS commissioner, and what I found is that it's well known at the IRS that they are facing extraordinarily serious problems. Nina Olson's report said the IRS is a, quote, institution in crisis. And another report she wrote said that if changes aren't made, that it could, quote, fail at its mission. And this is not just in reference to the better known controversies of the last year about whether the IRS is properly vetting nonprofit groups for their tax exempt status. This has to do with several things. Number one, the IRS makes billions of dollars in potentially fraudulent payments without knowing whether the refunds are going to the right person. The IRS relies heavily on tax preparers, many of whom are not regulated by the federal or state government. The IRS doesn't answer about 40% of the phone calls from taxpayers with a live person. And the budget cuts that Congress has put in for the last 3 or 4 years, for example, there's been a $1 billion B as in boy budget cut that's resulted in an $8 billion drop in revenue collection. So as the officials at the IRS told me, they believe they're being starved for funds. And as a result, revenues are going down. And there's also been an explosion in identity theft. So there's a series of problems that have led to this overall conclusion that the IRS is an institution in crisis.
You know, people may be skeptical when they hear a government agency saying it's being starved for funds. Like some people will say, oh, you know, right. And the IRS, most of all. Let's flesh these out to get the sense of exactly the scale of what's going on and just how outrageous some of this stuff is. On the fraudulent refunds, you're talking about billions, and some of the stories that are repeated again and again and again here are just kind of hair-raising. Give us a what's the basic dynamic of what's going on with refund fraud, Michael?
Well, there's two elements in particular. The basic problem, Tom, is that when the IRS gets your tax return, you've gotten your W-2 wage forms, other information, and oftentimes the IRS will then give you a refund if that's what you're deserving without having a chance to double check those tax returns against the same financial information that it would receive weeks after you do. So in other words, you get your W-2, the IRS doesn't get its own version from financial institutions until weeks later, often after you've gotten your refund.
And the biggest issue here is identity theft. So somebody might cut in front of me before I've even filed, claim my identity, claim a great big refund. The IRS gives it. They're required by law to give it quickly, you point out, mm-hmm. and on no basis at all.
Well, what happens is we have had an explosion in identity theft, and this is partly a result of an effort to get refunds out quickly, and criminal gangs or just individuals have found that they can scoop up Social Security numbers that they get illegally and a person's name and basically file thousands of tax returns with a Social Security number and a person's name and fill out certain things that will give a refund. And while a lot are automatically rejected for various reasons, they do get a lot. And just to put it in perspective, a few years ago, there were about 200,000 or more individuals affected by taxpayer identity theft And last year, in just the first 6 months alone, it was 1.6 million. So it's really risen a lot. And there's this underlying problem. It's not that the prosecutors aren't catching people fast enough. They've ratcheted up prosecution. But the overall way, the framework of the IRS doesn't enable it to automatically detect that a person who files a tax return with a certain Social Security number isn't actually that person. So it's just a deep underlying problem.
The tide of this kind of fraud has risen rapidly. The IRS kind of up against the wall here. Share with us the story you share in your excellent series on just one of these fraudsters, Rashia Wilson.
Right. Well, this was a case that was concluded last year in Tampa, and I cited that because she was particularly colorful. She, even though she was operating with what the prosecution said were stolen identities, she went on her Facebook page using her real name and proclaimed herself the queen of IRS tax fraud. And so I use that as an example. She was said by prosecutors to have bought a $92,000 Audi car. And she dared basically the IRS to catch her. Well, they did for various reasons. And there she was one individual in Tampa who was able to do this with the help of a alleged co-conspirator.
And we're talking millions, not just one $92,000 car here, but millions in alleged fraud.
Well, she was ordered for restitution to pay $3 million. So we know it's at least that much. And there's some accounts that said it was more. So clearly there was an awful lot of money. And in fact, what I found striking, and I quoted her defense attorney, not the prosecutor, but her defense attorney, saying the IRS really should change the way it does business, because here's someone. Let me just quote what he said. The defense attorney said in court that he hoped, quote, the IRS will figure out a way to prevent this from happening in the future so someone with a sixth grade education can't defraud them so easily. So his point was that if this person, his client, was able to defraud the IRS this way, imagine what criminal gangs can do. And that's what's happening. I interviewed the assistant attorney general for tax crimes here in Washington at the Justice Department. And she said, you know, there are gangs that are doing this. They see this as an easy way to get money. She stressed that, you know, the Justice Department is instituting measures to try to clamp down on this. But clearly, even if nine fraudulent tax returns are caught, the 10th one goes through, and they operate in volume. So they send in thousands of tax returns. Sometimes they use the names of deceased people, of children under 14 years old, people who wouldn't know that their Social Security number is being used to get a tax return. So there's all sorts of problems here.
And we're talking billions and billions, the IRS not able to keep up. Here's just one example. This is a hearing, tax-related identity theft, the Senate Special Committee on Aging last year. Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, Democrat, pressed the Inspector General George Russell on one instance in which the IRS issued 2,000 tax refunds to one home address.
How in the world can there not be a system in place that the IRS would catch? They were sending 2,000 refund checks to one address.
Senator, once again, we'd actually take credit because we identified that problem at the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration. In their defense, the Internal Revenue Service needs a statutory fix in order to limit, at our request, our recommendation, limit the number of returns that are issued to the same bank account, debit account, what have you.
No, you've got to be kidding.
They need a statutory fix. We'll come back to look at that with Michael Cranish of the Boston Globe, who's written about all this in tremendous detail. You can link to his stories at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's just go to the other end of the spectrum here for a moment, Michael, if we may. Taxpayers who want to do the right thing, who want to pay their taxes and are trying to figure out what to do and call or write the IRS. You're writing about IRS responsiveness being way, way down.
Yeah, I was very surprised by this, and I'm not the only one. The IRS has a new commissioner, John Koskinen. He just came on board in January, and I interviewed him at the IRS. And one of the things he told me was that he was stunned when he learned that 40% of the phone calls to the IRS, and we're talking about many millions of phone calls that are made per year, that 40% are not answered by a live operator. And what happens is the IRS has a policy they call the, quote, courtesy disconnect, unquote, policy, so that if your call goes on for a while, as a courtesy, they disconnect you.
You mean if nobody answers, if nobody picks up, they just cut you off?
Exactly. This doesn't happen to everybody, but it's a sign of how difficult the problem is. The IRS says this is a function of their budget having been cut by $1 billion in the last 4 years, and they don't have the manpower. Koskinen, the IRS commissioner, testified a couple of weeks ago before the House Ways and Means Subcommittee that basically the same thing should be expected this year because their budget situation is the same. And then next year, they're taking on enormous responsibilities for health care, and so the problem could be even worse. So he basically was very blunt. He actually issued a video on YouTube that you can go and look at in which he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that you should expect that if you call, it might be difficult to get through. You might not get through. And he urged people to go to the website.
Does he share the taxpayer advocate's concern that the IRS could fail at its mission?
Well, I asked him the question about do you view the IRS, as the taxpayer advocate said, as an institution in crisis? And he responded that he views it as one. He put it a little more gently, saying it's under great stress. He recognized, and this is a person who was brought in. He's a 74-year-old person who has a lifetime of experience in turning around operations, companies, government agencies. He's worked throughout Washington, different facilities. And the White House believed that although he basically had retired, that he was the one person that they felt was best qualified to come in and fix this. So he came in and he has this interesting mantra. He says, bad news is good news. And he says that's because he wants to know all the things that are problems so he can know what to fix.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about deep troubles at the IRS. Battered agency struggling to keep up these days. Michael Cranish is deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. He's written a big series looking at the troubles at the IRS, and they are deep and they are wide. He joins us today from Washington. You can link to all of his reporting on this at our website, onpointradio.org. You've got this issue, Michael, of tax preparers. And this was another eye-opener to me. I always thought that there was some kind of, I don't know, process they went through. You say you just kind of file a, what is it, $60, $70 application to tell them that you're not a convicted felon. And bingo, you're a tax preparer.
Right. You know, a lot of people probably do presume, as I did, and you just said, that if you go to a tax preparer, they have some kind of a qualification. You just basically laid out the rules. The rules are, as far as the federal government is concerned, that to be a tax preparer, you pay a fee of $64.25 to the IRS. You send them your recent tax return, and you explain any felony convictions, if any. That's according to the IRS website. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I quote the IRS commissioner as saying, you know, anybody can hang out a shingle and be call themselves a tax preparer.
Well, what's the problem with this, apart from the obvious lack of competence that somebody hiring them might get? What's the problem?
Well, just to be fair, I mean, there are obviously millions of people who are very good and competent well-trained tax preparers. So I'm sure that I know that there are because I've used them. You've mm-hmm. used them, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. The problem from the IRS standpoint is that they go through and they get millions of tax returns that have mistakes in them, problems with them. And they have believed for a long time that the way to help fix this is to require that tax preparers have to take some kind of licensing exam, take an annual update because the tax code is very complex, 4 million words of the code, and it changes from year to year, and that they would like to know that tax preparers are up on all this.
Why don't they just do that? Why don't they require it?
Well, they did. A couple years ago, they said we have the authority to do this, and they signed contracts to do this. They set up testing centers to do this. And then there was a group called the Institute for Justice. It's a libertarian group, and they basically sued the IRS, said, you don't have the authority to do this. And an appeals court agreed with them, and then a week or two ago, another court upheld that. So the IRS was basically told, you don't have the authority to do this. Now,
who would be against having competent tax preparers? What's this Institute for Justice?
Right. I asked the exact question. It's a libertarian group. It got its main initial funding from the Koch brothers, who are well-known financiers of conservative causes, although the Institute told me that the Koch brothers were not involved in this particular lawsuit. But they basically believe that there are a lot of instances of workers in this country who are over-licensed, over-regulated, and they're against that. And this was an instance they did not believe that the IRS had the authority to do this. And in fact, a court agreed with them. Congress could, you know, today pass a law saying taxpayers have to be regulated. That would solve the problem. States can do this, but only four states so far have actually required licenses for all tax preparers. Many states do license accountants, enrolled agents, things like that, tax lawyers, obviously. So a lot of preparers are regulated, but many millions are not regulated in any way whatsoever.
And one of the problems here you report is that these tax preparers, some of them are among those deeply involved in the fraud.
Well, this has been part of the problem. There's case after case in which tax preparers prey upon people. And basically, most of these people are lower income people. Many of them do not have English as a first language.
Prey on them what? And, steal their identity? And
well, they may. I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a number of cases where the tax preparer will file a tax return and basically make two copies. They'll give one to the client, which looks correct, and they'll actually file to the IRS a refund that's larger than it should be, take the excess for themselves. And so the client doesn't know that the preparer has done something improper. In other cases, they simply have taken Social Security numbers and identities and filed tax returns and said the money should be sent to themselves. And there's identity theft involved there. So that is part of the problem, is that some people who present themselves as tax preparers have done this. Obviously, this is a small number, but it can add up to a lot of money in the end.
They go after living tax filers. They go after, you report as well, those on lists of the dead, snag their Social Security number, punch that in, the IRS not nimble enough or allowed statutorily the kind of calendar that would let them respond. Michael Cranish writes it all up in a big series in the Boston Globe that really adds up to a picture of a very, very troubled agency responsible for bringing in the nation's revenue and a lot more. We'll look at that as well. We'll hear in a moment from the National Taxpayer Advocate, Nina Olson. I want to hear from our listeners as well, Michael. Barb in Toledo, Iowa. Thank you for calling, Barb. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
My grandson was killed, a 13-year-old, in the fall of 2012. And then when my son-in-law and daughter filed their tax refund last spring, they found that it had already been sent, the refund, to someone else.
So someone had gotten a hold of your, and I'm sorry for your family's loss. That's terrible. But someone, what, got his, your dead grandson's Social Security number or something, Barb?
Yes, somehow they were managed to do that and filed for the refund and got it. So this is not unusual to happen, I understand.
Well, I'm more sorry for the loss of the grandson, but this is not no fun on the other side of that. What was it like getting that straightened out for your son-in-law?
They eventually get their refund in late 2012.
So after some months, they got it straightened out. Barb, thank you for your call. Michael, there's an example.
You know, I've heard that kind of situation a number of times. After this series ran last week, I got a lot of emails from people, and they describe situations like this. And it just is a tragic situation because it compounds the harrowing experience of the death, as that caller just described. To have to then spend time on the phone to call the IRS and then probably not get through on your first try to get to the IRS and explain this problem. There's a statistic that I came across that said this was a study by the Treasury Department that it found took more than 300 days on average to resolve cases of identity theft. Now, the IRS says last year they improved that to 120 days. But either way, you know, just imagine if you've gone through the situation and then you call the IRS and it takes so long and it's so difficult to resolve. Now, what happens in this instance, I don't know exactly how that person's identity was stolen, but what has happened many times is that when a death happens, that that person's Social Security number goes on what's called the death master list, and that list unfortunately has been relatively publicly available. And, you know, so the criminals can go look and say, okay, here's a person who's died. We're going to take their Social Security number, file a tax return with that number, and the actual family doesn't know what's happened until they file the return. So I don't know if that's what happened in this case, but that is what's happened in many similar cases.
You've got these numbers from 2011, potentially fraudulent returns using Social Security numbers of 1,400 children under 14, 19,000 dead people, 37,000 prisoners, 750,000 people whose income level did not require a tax return. But in they came, and the IRS not in a situation to deal with that flood. Boy, Alan in Omaha, Nebraska. Alan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any particular individual issue or experience with the IRS, but I just had a broader complaint of just like the airing of the Senator McCaskill talking in the congressional hearing.
Yeah, with the 2,000 fraudulent refunds sent to one home address.
Sure, but where is the Congress kind of in this process? Because you just feel like she was unaware that there was whether or not it was true or not, but seemingly unaware that it needed a statutory fix in order to address some of these things. So it just feels like it adds to the list of incredulous acts that the Congress continues to do, and then they just kind of act aloof and crazy when these problems kind of rear their head And they're sitting with their hands in the hair, you know, in their shoulder shrugs, saying, I don't know how this kind of thing happened. So it just seems like it's another thing to add to the list of where is the Congress at in its part of creating these monstrosities in these agencies and then acting crazy when these issues rear their head to the
public. Alan, let us pick it up. I'm glad you ask it. I mean, Michael Cranish, this is fundamental to any country's shared life, and you don't want to mess with the faith and trust of your taxpayer citizens here. You're reporting, and that of Nina Olson we'll hear in just a minute, is talking about an institution in crisis. What are the politics of this in Congress? What are they? Are there plans afoot to get this fixed, or are there politics in the way? What's going on?
Well, you know, obviously a lot of people don't like the IRS, but it's Congress that writes the tax code. It's Congress that sets the budget. And if you talk to folks who follow this very closely, they'll say Congress shares a lot of the blame for this. They're the ones who've cut the budget, for example, by $1 billion, which resulted in a loss of $8 billion in revenue collections. They have been advised by Nina Olson, the taxpayer advocate, who's going to come on shortly, many times about let's do this to fix this, let's fix that problem. And some of the big fixes that have been proposed have not been enacted. Now, I talked to members of Congress. And basically what you hear back is that it's not politically popular to say, let's give more money to the IRS. Let's help them enforce tax rules more vigorously. In fact, what you often hear is the opposite. But the reality is this is how most of the government is funded. And most people do voluntarily, you know, try to pay their taxes in a fair way. But, you know, there are certain numbers that don't. And right now, Congress has been advised by various groups to institute what's called real-time tax return processing, and that would enable the IRS to look at a tax return and at the same time look independently at the W-2 forms, the financial information institution forms like interest and dividends and so forth, and verify things. Right now, they can't do that upfront in many cases, and that is at the heart of the problem.
Why not? Because the law says you can't do it, or because the turnaround time for refunds required by Congress is so quick?
It would require a change in the way we do our taxes. And a couple of years ago, in fact, the then IRS commissioner, Douglas Shulman, proposed just such a system. In 2011, he gave a big speech here in Washington and said we'd need a new way. I'm paraphrasing. It's in the story. We need a new way to basically collect our taxes. And he laid out this system, which would enable taxes to be verified up front and so forth, and acknowledged that it would require a change for people, that you might not get your refund quite as quickly, for example, other things like that. But basically, his suggestion was not heeded. It would take an effort by Congress and perhaps the president to push it to say, this is a serious problem. There's huge fraud, billions of dollars. Taxpayer identity theft has skyrocketed, and something new needs to be done. And it would take that kind of push. Right now, instead, we're in a situation where most of the focus is on what may be a valid issue, this issue of whether nonprofits are being properly scrutinized by the IRS, tax-exempt groups, and so forth. That's gotten most of the publicity. And so the oxygen of the rest of the story hasn't gotten, you know, as much attention.
Yeah.
But clearly, that's the purpose of this series, is that there are a lot of other problems going on, and we tried to point them out.
I mean, it all matters. But this is just central to the way any country operates. You don't want it to be a mess. Michael Cranish, stand by in Washington. With us as well from Washington now is Nina Olson. She is the National Taxpayer Advocate, is supposed to protect taxpayer interests within the IRS and represent before Congress as well. Nina Olson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, hi. How are you?
Well, we're okay, but this is a little unnerving. We read you last year calling the IRS an institution in crisis. Where do you point to justify that pretty scary phrase, Nina?
Well, part of where I used that phrase was in the context of the 501c4 controversy, when there was so much focus on that, calling that a crisis. And I thought, well, the IRS is in crisis, but it's not the crisis you all are paying attention to. You know, it's the crisis of the underfunding, of the under-resourcing, of the decreasing staff, the poor taxpayer, the declining taxpayer service. And something that we haven't talked about, the lack of training for IRS employees. You know, since 2010, the IRS training budget has been cut by 87%. And that's a stunning statistic.
Wow.
87%. And any entity, whether it's a private business, a public business, a nonprofit, to not train your employees, you know, that just has major impacts, and it's certainly going to have impact on the taxpayers of the United States.
Why would the IRS, we know the tax code is complicated, it's not easy, why cut training by 87%? That's almost complete cut.
Well, again, it goes back to there was an Inspector General audit pointing out a conference that was held and video that was done of Star Trek. And so there's this reaction. And the reaction was, we can't have any conferences. We can't have face-to-face training. We'll do everything by computer. And just cut. And you have to go through all sorts of levels of review to get training proposed, and people ultimately stop proposing training. And that goes on for several years, and then you get to where we are today. And, you know, I try to point out to people that you're interfacing with the taxpayers of the United States who are funding the United States. And if you don't know how to talk to them, if you don't know how to problem solve, if you don't know how to interview, and those are not skills that you learn by computer-based training.
Mm-hmm. And yet people call or try to call in. Michael Cranish reporting that they're so short-staffed that the IRS cannot answer nearly 40% of phone calls. Nina Olson, let me get a call here from Dave in Elroy, Wisconsin. Dave, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I had an experience a few years ago where I didn't know how to enter something on my tax forms. I called the IRS. They gave me advice. I followed their advice precisely. A few months later, I get a notice that I had underpaid my taxes based on what they told me to do, and that I needed to pay that plus the interest. I called them up, and I said, hey, I did this exactly the way you told me. Their reply to me was, well, everyone knows we give out bad advice, and that was the end of it.
So you had to pay a little more and got it straightened out, but you were acting on what they told you in the first place. Yeah. Dave, thanks for your call. Nina, what are the implications of this? If we don't get this fixed up one way or another, what's at stake here?
Well, I think that just what the caller indicated, I mean, how does that caller feel? That he tried to do what was right. He thought he got advice from the tax agency itself. He followed it, and then he has to pay more. And I think that that ultimately erodes people's confidence in the system. And I keep saying, you know, it'll make it harder for people to do what is right, even when they're trying to do what is right. And this year, as a result of the budget cuts, astonishingly, and this goes to my, you know, the institution in crisis point, the IRS has said that it will only answer basic tax law questions, and it will only answer them up to April 15th. So if you file an extension and you want to know what's the right filing status, should I file as married filing separately, married filing jointly, head of household, on April 16th, there will be nobody there to answer that phone call, and they will point you to the website. But some, you know, you can, it's very difficult to people need some back and forth in order to flesh out their situation.
Yeah.
And what the IRS is basically doing is saying we're walking away from that service. So where do taxpayers go? Well, they go to return preparers then. So I've been viewing this as we are actually putting a compliance surtax on the actual act of preparing a tax return.
You mean to pay for that tax preparer.
Filing your return with the government. And then that brings in the whole issue of what Michael was talking about before, and I've covered since 2002, which is the lack of regulation of the unenrolled return preparers, who prepare the vast majority of the individual income tax returns that are prepared by preparers in this country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about deep troubles at the IRS. Battered agency, struggling, it appears, to keep up. Michael Cranish writes about it for the Boston Globe in a big series you can link to at our website, onpointradio.org. All kinds of issues in fraud, refund fraud. It'll kind of takes your breath away, the scale of it, getting through to the IRS, processing. Budget's been cut, but as a result, billions lost in tax collections. Nina Olson is with us as well today. She is the national taxpayer advocate, keeps track of all this, talks to citizens about it, talks to Congress about it. She has called the IRS an institution in crisis right here in tax-paying season. Lots of fraud on those refunds. Here's a 57-year-old Marcy Hosley of Florida testifying. This is before the Senate Special Committee on Aging. Last spring, said she didn't realize she'd been a victim of identity theft until the IRS told her someone had used her personal information to receive tax refunds for 2 years. She described her experience of trying to get those refunds straightened out.
I later spoke with another woman at the IRS who told me it was my own fault that I hadn't received my refund and that I should have received a letter in the mail with my caseworker's name on it. When I told her to please reissue the letter because I had never received it, she said it could not be reissued. She was quite angry with me and made me feel stupid and small because she said I was just one of many people dealing with the same problem. I was near tears on the phone.
One of many people dealing with this problem, billions lost here. And that's just the beginning of the list of issues, fundamental problems, Michael Cranish calls them, at the IRS. Let's hear from our listeners. Lake Worth, Florida, Gabriel is calling. Hi, Gabriel, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I think this is a great example of how underfunding an agency or program can end up wasting our money even more so than overfunding. And I hope that people will look at this and apply that thought to many other underfunded agencies and programs, like mine inspections comes to mind. Maybe we could prevent some disasters.
Or maybe chemical safety near water sources. We saw that in West Virginia. But Gabriel, you may remember last year the reports of the IRS going off to fancy conferences and making expensive Star Trek videos and all the rest. A lot of people were upset by that use of government funds, Gabriel.
Well, I don't think I'm going to comment on that because I don't know enough about it. I'm going to take my comments off the air unless you have more questions.
No, that's you're a good and careful citizen there, Gabriel. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Larry in Columbia, South Carolina. Larry, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I'm a former IRS employee, worked there for over 32 years. I was an attorney, and it's been an interesting process of watching the agency decline, and quite frankly, some of it would appear to be an indication of a political decline, induced decline. The especially during the Republican regimes, there's been, you know, government can't do anything right. And actually, and during that time, you had freezes on employment. So what you have after so many years through attrition, you have a loss of institutional knowledge, people that would have had experience and know the code intimately.
Yeah.
In addition to that, you've had a decline in support from Congress. And it's easy to beat up on the IRS because we're, of course, hamstrung by not being able to defend ourselves because of disclosure statutes that are applicable to us. So when someone makes some claims that IRS has done this or that, and you notice in most of these so-called IRS scandals, you hear these accusations, these terrible things IRS has done, and then a year, 18 months later, as reporters have looked further into it, you discover that those so-called scandals were mostly just hot air or people with a political agenda. And speaking of political agendas, I would say most certainly there is a very sizable segment of Congress who believes government is the enemy, who wants to make sure that the IRS is hamstrung, and then say, look, see, they don't do a good job. But of course, they are responsible for that.
Larry, I appreciate your call, especially with your 32 years experience at the IRS. Michael Cranish, what about the politics here? We hear it from Lake Worth, Florida. We hear it from Columbia, South Carolina. People wondering about agendas at work here that may be, at least in part, to blame for the problems.
Well, you do hear that a lot. The people who would like to see the IRS get fuller funding say that there are some members of Congress who do not want to provide that as sort of punishment, that they don't believe that if they somehow believe that if the IRS has less funding, that taxes will go down. Of course, it's up to Congress to set the tax rate, and that's what happens. I asked the head of a House Ways and Means subcommittee about this when the IRS commissioner testified before that committee a couple of weeks ago. And what he essentially said, he acknowledged, he said there's a lot of other problems that we obviously need to address. But he said we still have this trust issue. This was a Republican. He said we still have this problem with our concerns about what the IRS did in examining various tax-exempt groups that he thought were mostly targeted that were conservative. And he said until they get over that, it's going to be hard to deal with other problems. But the investigations that are going on, there's six investigations at last count of that matter, and they could go on for months or years.
You're talking about from the uproar last spring over IRS allegedly giving trouble to political nonprofits and it's conservative groups were the first to charge there. It later came out that they had looked into liberal groups as well. Where did the balance end up on that, Michael?
Well, this is what I think people are waiting to look for the investigations to conclude on. The charge from conservatives, from Republicans, basically was that the IRS went after Tea Party-type groups. Democrats said, well, wait a second, we've got evidence that they also went after liberal-type groups. And until the investigations are complete, it might be difficult to say, you know, were all groups targeted? There's this overarching problem of, should the IRS deny tax-exempt status to groups that are overtly political? That's the bigger issue. The IRS is separately trying to come up with regulations for that. And because those regulations have been deemed by many to be too vague, we have this problem of interpretation. And that's how that controversy came to be.
And so that gets all the heat. Meanwhile, the actual regular functioning of the IRS, we hear from our 32-year veteran, declining over time. Let me go to Cookeville, Tennessee. Kay is calling. Hi, Kay. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to ask something from an employer's perspective.
Great.
Every year we report the earnings, Social Security number, name, gross earnings, and all the taxes withheld to the IRS.
Sure.
And those have to be tied into everything from us, all our quarterlies, et cetera. When these people are filing fraudulent returns, is the IRS not cross-checking like 2,000 returns to the employer's W-2 forms that they've reported?
It's a great question. Michael gets into it. Nina, I'm sure you followed it as well. Can you explain to our employer, Kay, in Tennessee, how this could happen? Why isn't there more cross-checking so that there's not a gap, there's not room for all this fraud?
Well, the problem is that although the employers send in the information, they send it in after the beginning of the filing season, and the W-2s go first to Social Security Administration, who sort of cleans up the data, mm-hmm. and then sends it over to the IRS. So the IRS doesn't start getting it until sometime in March, and by that point, you've had either a month or or 5 weeks of the filing season, and a lot of refunds go out in the very beginning of the filing season.
I saw a report last week, this is early mid-February, they'd already sent out $64 billion in refunds this process has gone through, you're saying.
Right, and that's we had a late start filing season. So, you know, so what I proposed in 2009 or 2010, and the former commissioner picked up, and we reiterated again this year, writing an in-depth piece in our annual report this December to Congress about what you could do in order to bring about what some people are calling the real-time tax system, is you have to sort of play around with when should the filing season start? When should we tell brokerage houses, et cetera, you need to get this information into us? And then when do we start issuing refunds out to taxpayers? Many tax systems around the world, this is actually very interesting, hold off paying refunds out to their taxpayers until the filing season is actually ended. So if our filing season ends on April 15th, then you wouldn't get your refunds until, say, 30 days, 45 days later.
But that means at least you'd have all the information in. So if you're the IRS, you wouldn't. I mean, what's happening now, as Michael reports it, is somebody may file a fraudulent return on my behalf, get it in there full of bogus numbers, get a refund, and be gone before I ever file in the first place, Nina.
Correct. And you know, I want to give the IRS some credit here. It has, over the years, built up many, many filters to try to identify fraudulent returns. And many of the largest employers in the United States give us a separate database from what they're filing, you know, a duplicate of what they're filing with Social Security, so we can run some of those. But we really need a systemic approach. And my point about that crisis thing is that if the IRS's funding is decreased so much that all it can do is put out fires, it will never be able to make the investment of resources and energy and funding to pull off something like this real-time tax system, which is really necessary in the 21st century.
And it's not impossible. Michael Cranish quotes you in the Globe saying you compare it, that is what our IRS is doing, you compare it to what other countries are doing, and it's a joke, you say, Nina.
Yep. Yep. Well, it is. I mean, we are going backwards vis-a-vis other countries. And I think the commissioner even said, you know, we're back in the late 80s, early 90s. We're in a 20th century tax administration system instead of a 21st tax century tax administration. And the message I've tried to give to Congress is, you know, I understand their anger and their distrust. I mean, that's a reaction, but you know, it's okay, I can see this. But you're not punishing the IRS as an institution when you defund it or give it less funding. You are punishing your constituents. You are punishing your taxpayers. And that is fraught with problems, including that compliance by the people who are trying to comply with the laws will decline, as well as the people who aren't trying to comply with the laws.
I mean, in my experience looking around the world, when countries that don't have well-functioning tax systems, just efficient and competent and clean, those are countries that get in trouble. David and Franklin. Yeah, sorry, Nina, please.
No, I was just going to say the IRS brings in, you know, over 90% of the federal revenue. 98% of what the federal government, of what the IRS brings in, is attributable to taxpayer service. Only 2% is attributable to our enforcement actions. So if we're not picking up the phone, if we're not answering tax law questions, if we're not answering our mail, if we're not training our employees to be able to give the right answers, you know, it goes to that 98% of our collections.
Michael, on top of this, then, the IRS has already been asked to do some other big kind of extracurricular activities, and they have more coming at them with the Affordable Care Act. What about those pieces and those really burdens away from the core function, Michael?
Well, this is a really good question. It's something I looked at in the series, and that is that certainly Republicans have been saying, look, if the IRS is having problems, how can they possibly implement the Affordable Care Act changes?
Well, they're supposed to determine what your income is, to determine, I guess, what care your coverage you're eligible for.
Potential penalties,
yeah.
Things like that. Mm-hmm. Just as background, something else I wrote about is the problem the IRS has in implementing what's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. It's a program that helps lower income families get out of poverty. It's got bipartisan support.
Very popular with Republicans these days, actually.
It is. But the problem is that they have an improper payment rate, quote unquote, of 22%, which is one of the worst rates of any program at any agency.
That would be overpayment of 22% because why?
Well, not overpayment, but it could be actually be underpayment technically.
Oh, okay.
But it's what the government calls, quote, improper payment, because at the end of the day, they look at the forms and say, you know, this wasn't done properly. And there's no way to know if certain of those, you know, would have been paid anyway if the form had been correctly filled out. But the bottom line is year after year, Treasury auditors say, you know, here's the improper payment rate, and it gets improved a tiny bit at the margins. But the bottom line is they've not been able to significantly improve it, and now they're going to take on a massive new social program, basically healthcare, implementing a social program. This is done differently than, for example, how the federal government does food stamps. In the food stamps program, the government investigates whether you qualify, and then they give you the money. And with that, they have an improper payment rate. I think it's like 3-something percent. It's in the story. So while people may have heard about fraud in the food stamp program, it's actually a much lower improper payment rate than a program that basically has to be run through the IRS. And I quote a former IRS commissioner in one of the stories as saying, this is at the heart of many of the problems that we've turned the IRS into a de facto social welfare agency trying to determine whether someone is qualified. And he suggests taking that away from the IRS and letting the IRS go back to basically being a tax revenue collection agency.
We go to David in Franklin, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I think we're living with the consequences of what started in the 80s under Reagan with the philosophy of starving the beast. I mean, we want to have a good IRS, and yet we drastically cut their funding. We want the best teachers in the world, but our teachers get paid less than just about any other developed country. We want to have, you know, healthy water, and I used to work as a safety engineer some years back, and, you know, OSHA was a joke, you know, because we knew we'd never get inspected. If we did get inspected, it wouldn't be, you know, be a $5,000 fine for a company that makes millions and billions of dollars.
David, our time is short right here, but we've got that perspective loud and clear. Nina, respond to that. There's this report last year, Michael has it as well, warning the IRS could fail at its mission if there aren't changes made soon. Do you see those coming, Nina? And if not, it already sounds like we've got significant elements of failure here. What's the risk, the bigger risk?
Well, I think that part of these conversations in Michael's article and my annual reports is to say to Congress, you've gone too far, and there's going to be major bad things happening if you don't correct that path. And I think that there's beginning to be a recognition that they have done that. I have to say that what I see this as is that it's like the iris is like any organism. Where it's threatened, it's going to take the blood away from the less important parts of its body and direct it to the more important parts, the brain. So the iris is going to protect the filing season, but it's going to take its resources away from things that are very important but less important than the filing season.
Michael Cranish, do you see a consensus for change coming here to avoid that failure at mission?
I don't see it this year because they're so focused on the examination of the tax-exempt groups. But, you know, these reports and things like this, perhaps people will start paying attention to some of the other problems at the IRS.
Nina Olson, National Taxpayer Advocate in Washington. Thank you for joining us this hour, Nina.
Thank you.
And Michael Cranish with the Boston Globe. Thank you for your good reporting, and thanks for being here today, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
Link to that story at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.